and the Miller Center family have in common is that there are communities in both cases. The Foreign Service people who work together constitute a wonderful family of people who have faced great challenges, and more than the public generally realizes, have great accomplishments to their record. The Miller Center family, I think, is worth calling attention to from time to time. A great deal of the good things that happen at the Miller Center are a direct result of some of you around this table and in the outer room who make possible our programs. Bill Horbally is one such person. He served in Moscow with Ambassador Davies. He also was the assistant administrator of the Foreign Agricultural Service Organization in Washington, and I've asked him to introduce our speaker.
It gives me pleasure to introduce a good friend and colleague, Ambassador Richard Davies. He's had a long and distinguished career in numerous posts overseas, the latest being Ambassador to Poland. Currently, Ambassador Davies is president of the Research Center for Religion and Human Rights in Closed Societies. He was formerly chairman of the Board of Directors of Solidarity Endowment in Washington from 1983 till 1989, when events in Poland rendered the organization obsolete, I would say. He has been involved in many other activities, too numerous to mention. He might, after the meeting, if you wish to discuss any of them, you might talk to him. But rather than delay the very interesting presentation which Ambassador Davies has, I present to you Ambassador Davies.
Thank you very much, Bill. It's good indeed to be with you today. As you see, as I saw, the program that Ken Thompson put out said I'd talk about events in Poland and the Soviet Union. And I think, as you see from the little piece of paper you have, I'm diverging rather from that topic, which seems to have become rather restrictive in the light of recent events. And I want to talk about U.S. policy in the light of events in the Soviet Union, Poland, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, East Germany, all of East Central Europe. I call this presentation As the Empire Crumbles, the Havel Plan, and the Challenge for U.S. Policy. And I'd initially thought I'd start off this way. This was a couple of months ago when I was thinking about this. A funny thing happened on our way to the 21st century. Peace broke out, and nobody seemed to notice. The Cold War ended, but nothing fundamental changed. Why? Because for a long time now, in my view, the U.S. has not been fulfilling its role as what we used to call the leader of the free world, or the leader of the Western Alliance. Well, that was what I was going to lead off with. And then This past Sunday, I read a story, Jim Hoagland's story in the Washington Post, about Mrs. Katharine Graham's interview with the new president of Czechoslovakia, Václav Havel. And the story led off this way. President Václav Havel has scheduled visits to Washington and to Moscow and Washington within the next few weeks to press for Soviet and U.S. troop withdrawals from Europe as part of the new European security order that Czechoslovakia will propose to the superpowers. Aides said he will go to the Soviet capital by the 1st of February and to Washington for a 3-day visit around February 16th. So, that sounded, rang a bell with me. Soviet and U.S. troop withdrawals from Europe. The story was misleadingly headlined, Havel to press for troop cuts. But that's not quite what he was saying. He was saying troop withdrawals. And he's going to be talking about a new European security order. So the playwright president obviously is about to submit his most ambitious scenario. In more normal times, a scenario that would be judged so far-fetched that it could hardly reach the stage of the Laterna Magica in Prague, the theater which has been at the center of so many of the events of the past couple of months in Prague. It could hardly reach the stage of the Laterna Magica even in the absence of state censorship. Today, as a result of the events of the Annus Mirabilis 1989, and of Václav Havel's stature as the leader of Czechoslovakia's Velvet Revolution, we can hope his scheme, his plan for a new European security order, will receive a respectful hearing, not only in Moscow, but also in Washington. Of course, we can't know in advance what the details of his proposal are going to be. I certainly have no inside information. Understandably, he wants first to make his presentations to Gorbachev and to President Bush. But we will find some hints about what the Havel plan may contain in the Prague Challenge of March the 14th, 1985, which Charter 77 addressed to the Amsterdam Peace Conference of July 1985, and which was signed by Havel and many other adherents of Charter 77 who are now members of the Czechoslovak government and leaders of the Civic Forum. The Prague Challenge called for an end to the division of Europe into hostile military and power blocks, for the reunification of Germany as the indispensable first step on the road to restoring the cultural and spiritual unity of Europe, for the withdrawal of all foreign armies from Europe, and for the interposition of a neutral Central Europe between the power blocks. It was a modest little proposal. As a leading spokesman of Charter 77, Havel had been invited to address the Amsterdam Peace Conference of 1985, but he was unable to leave the country for fear he would not be permitted to return to his homeland. So he wrote an essay designed to help Western peace activists, led by E.P. Thompson. He'd been having a long debate with E.P. Thompson, the British peace activist. He wanted to help them understand the positions of their Central and East Central European counterparts. And he sent this essay to the conference. Professor Erazim Kohak of Boston University, a member of an earlier generation of dissidents who left Czechoslovakia in 1968, translated both these documents, the Prague Challenge and Václav Havel's essay, into English, and they were published in 1985 by the Harta 77 Foundation in Stockholm under the title The Anatomy of a Reticence, Eastern European Dissidents and the Peace Movement in the West. And as it happens, I have a copy. So when I read this in the Post, as I say, the light went on and bells began to ring. In 1985, Havel wrote about the difficulty of coming to terms with, quote, the reality of political actions. What actually should we be demanding? And what political measures in what order would we expect Europe to take? An initial difficulty is that even when East European dissidents do have definite views on this matter, those views differ widely. Havel then described those differing views. There are some, he wrote, who believe that the first step toward a genuine peace should be the creation of a belt of neutral states in Central Europe, in place of the present sharp frontier between the two blocs. Others would suggest outright a simple dissolution of the two military blocs and a withdrawal of American and Soviet armies from the territories of their European allies, which would naturally have to lead to a liquidation of all nuclear weapons stationed in or aimed at Europe. Another voice seeks to show that Europe will remain divided as long as Germany remains divided. For that reason, and not simply because of the German right to unification, we should first and foremost raise the demand of a German peace treaty, which would confirm the present European frontiers, but which would at the same time offer the two German states a prospect of a gradual confederation. Once the German problem has been resolved, a dissolution of the two pacts might be far more realistic. This perspective, Havel wrote, is rather persuasive. Would a Europe without pacts and without the protection, actually, he wrote, protection in quotation marks, of the superpowers, be imaginable at all if Berlin were to remain cut in twain by a wall and the German problem unresolved? So, writing in 1985, Havel discounted all these proposals as impractical, indeed utopian, and he called them Dadaism. He said, they're absurd, because, he said, surely the Soviet Union will not be willing simply to give up several of its European client states and to guarantee their neutrality to boot. Today, though, the Soviet Union has effectively given up all of its European client states, all that is, except the German Democratic Republic, to which it is clinging by means of the presence of the 400,000 to 450 1,000 effectives of the group of Soviet forces in Germany. The Berlin Wall has fallen, and the question of German unification or reunification is primarily one of when and secondarily one of how rather than one of if. Václav Havel himself is no longer dodging from pillar to post, one step ahead of the Czech secret police, or serving prison sentences. He is president of the Czechoslovak Republic. And here in the United States, there is general recognition that the taxpayer and the deficit-heavy U.S. budget need relief from the crushing burden of supporting NATO to the tune of between $150 and $170 billion a year. That burden, Jack Beatty wrote last June in The Atlantic, is significantly more than the defense contributions of the other 15 NATO members put together, according to a recent congressional report on burden sharing, which is NATO speak for who pays what. In 1986, we, that is the American taxpayer, spent
$1,155 per capita on defense, while our alliance partners spent an average of $318 per capita on defense. So we find today President Bush giving priority at the Malta summit to the conventional forces in Europe negotiations and calling for the conclusion of a CFE treaty by the end of 1990. This objective was concurred in by Soviet President Gorbachev, although Gennady Gerasimov, his spokesman, expressed doubt about the practicability of the timetable. He wasn't sure we could reach agreement by the end of this year. Such cuts are all the more essential since the threat against which the NATO alliance was formed, the very casus federis of the North Atlantic Treaty, that is, a Soviet attack on Western Europe, or more precisely on Western Germany, is no longer credible. George Kennan has termed absolute nonsense and silly the belief that NATO's most urgent task is to frustrate an attack on Western Europe by a militant Soviet Union accompanied by its supposedly faithful and equally militant Warsaw Pact allies. For example, a battalion commander of the German Democratic Republic Army, the East German Army, was recently quoted by a Western correspondent as saying of the Soviet forces in his country, "They keep to themselves. I cannot imagine us joining with them to attack the West." And you will find in yesterday's Washington Post and New York Times stories on the testimony of CIA Director Webster and the leaders of other branches of our intelligence establishment confirming these views. So Ambassador Kennan and Senator Nunn are calling for much deeper cuts in the levels of conventional forces on both sides of the Central Front than the United States now appears prepared to contemplate. Still, President Bush is insisting upon the necessity of maintaining U.S. troops in Western Germany. He contends that our European allies want this, although there has apparently been no effort to find out if, in view of that desire, they will pay for the service. The president refuses to agree with Gorbachev that the Cold War is over. He said to a questioner who asked him about this on December the 4th during his news conference in Brussels, "If I signal to you there's no Cold War, then you'll say, well, what are you doing with troops in Europe? Surely, if the American taxpayer is to continue to be asked to support a defense budget, 60% of which, 60% of which goes to maintain troops in Europe, he should have a better explanation for the expenditure than the president's desire to avoid having to agree that the Cold War is over." Does the Soviet threat of an attack on Western Germany still exist or not? If it does still exist, then President Bush is urging that the conventional forces in Europe negotiation be accelerated and the number of Soviet and NATO troops substantially reduced is fundamentally mistaken. If it does not, if that threat no longer exists, and the very urgency with which the CFE is being pursued is the clearest evidence that the U.S. government believes it does not exist any longer, then the American taxpayer critically needs relief from the burden of sustaining U.S. troops in Western Europe, a burden that has contributed so greatly to making the United States a debtor nation with obligations that will endure unto the third and fourth generations. What objectives should the U.S. now be pursuing in Europe? We should be encouraging the withdrawal of Soviet troops from all of East Central Europe. Instead, we appear to be compounding with the Soviet military in keeping them there through our pursuit of the long drawn out CFE negotiations. You know, the president has said, well, we will have the first tranche of these reductions in accordance with the first CFE negotiation, and we'll get down to levels of about 300,000 on either side, or maybe 275,000 on either side of the Central Front, that is American and Soviet troops, 275,000. And then we'll have a second tranche. And, you know, that'll take another couple of years. We should be seeking to reduce our own military involvement, so burdensome to American fiscal policy. We should be seeking to promote a post-Cold War settlement in Europe that does not depend for its enforcement primarily on plans to wage all-out war on the densely populated terrain of the subcontinent, but provides instead for continuing U.S. involvement in monitoring the peace. Sometime in February, Václav Havel hopes to visit Washington. What kind of proposal is he going to present when he gets here? Well, as I insist on repeating, I have no inside knowledge. I certainly don't know the content of the Havel plan. Its main elements, however, are quite evident from a reading of the Prague Challenge and Anatomy of a Reticence, which Havel wrote in 1985. The Havel plan, I guess, will require a single package that would involve two principal bargains between East and West, or more narrowly, between the United States and the Soviet Union, and between both East and West on one side and Germany on the other. The first bargain would be U.S. and Soviet agreement to the reunification of Germany in exchange for German recognition of the current boundaries of the existing German states. And this is very important, particularly for Poland, but also for all the other East Central European states with which Germany was once at war. The second bargain would consist in the acceptance by Germany of denuclearization and demilitarization in return for a continuing joint superpower guarantee of the neutrality of Central Europe. Now, instead of describing to you in abstract terms the elements and issues of the bargains of which I've spoken, I have instead reduced them, as we used to say in the State Department, reduced them to this draft, which I hope will serve as a basis for our discussion. It is a notional draft. I'm not claiming that this will be the Havel plan. I can't say too often that I don't know what he's going to present to the two presidents. And I know, too, that this draft is hardly something that I would expect the two governments simply to, or all the governments involved, simply to sit down and sign. Instead, a peace settlement in Europe would obviously consist in an imposing edifice of interrelated documents, international instruments. That's why I call this a draft notional. Now, I assume you've already had a chance to read it. I'm not going to bore you every such document has a preamble. So this is a preamble. And then there is what I regard as the central issue here, that is a provision for the delineation of the boundaries of the present German states and any possible successor state for themselves and for any successor state or states. The FRG and the GDR recognize their boundaries with Austria, Belgium, Czechoslovakia, Denmark, France, Luxembourg, the Netherlands, and Poland as they exist today and are precisely delineated in the protocol that constitutes part of this agreement. The Germans forswear any effort to alter those boundaries and recognize that the sovereignty of the peoples of those states within them may not be questioned in any way. Well, the international lawyers are just going to have a field day if, as and when we ever get around to drafting this treaty. But that, there are some ideas there. Then the question of German statehood. In exchange for German recognition of the boundaries, the Allies recognize the right of all the Germans to determine for themselves in free elections the forms of political association under which they will live. In other words, let them work out for themselves, whether it be the Federation and what the timing of unification or reunification would be. But then there's a provision for denuclearization, which is taken straight from the Rapotsky plan, that Polish Foreign Minister Adam Rapotsky, a quantum socialist, but perforce a communist at the time, presented to the United Nations some 30 years ago, providing that there will be no nuclear weapons on the territories of the contracting states. And I think the states that are involved would be primarily, of course, the two Germanys and Czechoslovakia, Hungary, and Poland. You can widen that ban as far as you like. Then demilitarization. This would be, of course, the nub of the matter so far as Germany's East Central European neighbors are concerned. The signatories welcome the declarations of the parliaments of the two German states and of Belgium, Czechoslovakia, Denmark, Estonia, Hungary, Latvia, Lithuania, the Netherlands, and Poland, providing for A, the destruction of their offensive weapons. Big problem, the international lawyers and the defense departments to define what are offensive weapons. B, the reduction of the size of their armed forces to a level that will preclude any fear by their neighbors of a possible attack, and their transformation into bodies adequate to guard and defend their borders and to maintain public order. And C, the inspection of the fulfillment of these processes by the joint monitoring organizations that should be set up to ensure both denuclearization and demilitarization on either side of what we used to call the Iron Curtain. Finally, semi-final, supranational organizations. The European community should take this occasion to make some, specify some conditions for membership in the European community, because that is bound to be the ultimate goal of certainly Poland, Czechoslovakia, and Hungary. They will want sooner or later to join the European community, and the European community has to define that. They're very nervous about this now. They don't really want these odds and sods in there, little people from the East about whom one knows so little. And finally then, when all this has been done to the satisfaction of all concerned, you could say NATO and the Warsaw Pact, North Atlantic Treaty Organization, the Warsaw Treaty Organization, are no longer relevant to the maintenance of security in Europe. So with that, I think I hope I sense that I've stirred up a few hornets one place and the other. I hope so, at any rate. And we can discuss the the draft you've got. I don't want to
Both Bill and I made an important omission, and he's going to rectify it.
I apologize. A very important omission. Gene Davies, the other half of the Davies team.
If she wants to, better. She ought to have the privilege of asking the first question.
No, thank you.
Okay, who'd like to ask the first question? Jack.
Oh. Why is Austria left out of the people's in the preamble?
Well, because Austria is in a peculiar situation. There already is a peace treaty with Austria. We've got a peace treaty. So they don't... I've included Austria in the paragraph on boundaries, because there is a problem with Austria. As Stalin used to say, we of the older generation. We of the older generation, remember. And that is the danger that a reunited or united Germany at some point, who knows, might say, well, now we're reunited, let's have the whole Deutschland again and get all the German speaking, get the Austrians in too. So there should be some assurance, it seems to me, for the other peoples in Europe against that. Now let me say too, look, this is a scrap of paper we're talking about. This is a treaty we're talking about. Treaties, regrettably, have proven not to be very sure guarantees of anything in this century of ours. I recognize that full well. That's why I've put the Joint Monitoring Organization in here, because without monitoring of the fulfillment of the provisions of the treaty on a constant basis, you really have nothing.
Next question. Wilfred Grandpa.
I've just read a book called Infinity in All Directions by a fellow called Freeman Dyson.
Yeah, right.
He recommends, in one chapter in there, he recommends almost exactly what you've got here. And on top of that, the only thing he says that the two Germanys would have to allow no foreign troops on their soil and belong to no military alliance.
Well, right. I forgot. You know, after I did this draft treaty, which I did in November, I'd forgotten all about Anatomy of a Reticence, Václav Havel's 1985 document. Obviously, I retained something from it, and I also read Friedman Dyson's
Infinity in All Directions.
Well, I read the excerpting of that book in the New Yorker, and again, that was quite a long time ago. So I'm afraid I wasn't ascribing any of these ideas precisely to, but these ideas, as Bob Dylan would say, have been blowing in the wind, lo, these 30 and 40 years. George Kennan, in the fourth brief lecture, spoke about the essence of what is the paragraph on demilitarization, that is, the reduction of the military forces of the European states, essentially, to self-defense militias. And I already mentioned the Rapotsky Plan. So these ideas have been around for a while, and they've been proposed by one side or the other, and by one element of one side or the other on many occasions.
What are the chances of getting this through?
Well, that, I think, is a very big question, and that's something that worries me a great deal with Václav Havel. I mean, assuming that he's going to say this, and I can't see what else he can say that would constitute a new security order in Europe, as advertised, how is it going to be received? It'll be received with great enthusiasm, I believe, obviously in the two Germanies. You're talking about unification, which is the striving now, certainly of all the East German, of the East German masses, again, as we of the older generation used to say, the East German masses are striving for unification. There is a small minority in East Germany consisting of intellectuals, some of the pastors who were extremely important in the dissent movement and in creating what happened or helping create what happened in Germany, and the remnants of the Socialist Unity Party, the East German Communist Party. Some of these people want some kind of retro Germany, which would be characterized by a sort of socialism which they haven't been able to define yet. And which would exclude manifestations of Western popular culture, vulgar consumerism, and capitalistic materialism. But some of those people are quite worthy. I exclude the SED, the Socialist Unity Party people, from that adjective. But That's a forlorn hope. The masses of East Germans want reunification. That becomes apparent from the Monday evening demonstrations in Leipzig, where initially they were demonstrating and calling on the East German government for democratic reforms. Now they're calling for reunification. So it would be greeted with great enthusiasm, I believe, in East Germany, and I believe also among the youth, certainly, in West Germany. East Central Europeans, I'm convinced, with very few exceptions, would be very enthusiastic about it. They want to get rid of their armies. What good are their armies to them? At any moment, with the press of a button, Mr. Gorbachev or his successor, President Bush or his successor, could take them out. So what good are armies to these people now? Do we need an army in Germany? With the idea of using it for what? We don't need an army in Germany. I don't believe the Germans think they need an army in Germany. I think the liberals, so-called, in the Soviet Union, the reformers in the Soviet Union, would greet it. Gorbachev, I believe, will give qualified approval to it. Qualified not because his own attitude towards it would be qualified. No, I think he will greet it privately. But qualified because he wouldn't want to give it the kiss of death by being too enthusiastic about it, the kiss of death in the eyes of the Western leaders. It is in the West, unfortunately, that I fear we will find a certain amount of, well, what was it G.K. Chesterton said, that always keep a hold of nurse for fear of finding something worse. So there is a great attachment to NATO now after all these years, and understandably so. It's performed an enormous function. As a quondam political officer working in NATO, I'm very conscious of that. But is its day not over, and should we not recognize that realistically? But I'm afraid it's in the West that it will not be greeted very enthusiastically. Mrs. Thatcher is not there. Won't be for it. I dare to think. President Mitterrand will not be for it, obviously, for obvious reasons. You know, Germany, the Germany that emerges from such a peace settlement, will dominate Europe. It already dominates Europe economically. And it will just dominate it all the more because there won't be any defense burden on the German taxpayer. There wouldn't be if this plan were to go into effect. In fact, that would be a big advantage for the Germans. The West would have to rethink completely, from scratch, its national security assumptions. And we don't like to. I don't blame us. We don't like to rethink assumptions. We're much more comfortable with the ones we got, but I've gone on too long.
With Gorbachev having so much difficulty holding his own country together now, what is to prevent the two Germanys from simply going ahead and working out between them an association, a common government, a scheme of reunion, and saying to the U.S. and other meddlesome foreigners, we don't need all these U.S. lawyers, we don't need these great treaties or anything of that sort. We'll just work out something between ourselves.
Excellent point. I'd say there's very little in the way of their doing something, and that's going to begin, I would guess. I hate to be guessing so much here, but I don't have any crystal ball. I would guess with the elections in East Germany on May the 6th, if indeed they take place as scheduled, the Volkskammer, the East German parliament, has said there will be free elections, as free as we as all the circumstances will allow, in East Germany on May the 6th. Now, of course, the opposition in East Germany is very fragmented and weak. There's an excellent reason for that. There's nobody there who can simultaneously say we want to have a separate East Germany, and yet we're against the present system, and who can get support from the masses? The people want reunification. So I believe that when that election takes place, in one form or the other, there already are parties forming in East Germany which will be recognized as the bearers of the reunification idea, and I think they will sweep the boards. And after that, what is to stop the two Germanys from forming? That is why I think it is rather urgent, while we still have some bargaining power left, to go ahead and do what happens after every war ends, conclude a peace treaty. Now, President Bush, speaking December the 4th in Brussels, said, no way, no way. He said, self-determination must be pursued without prejudice to its outcome. He was speaking about this question of reunification of Germany. And we should not at this time endorse any particular vision. That's fair enough. You know, we can't make the decision. The Germans must. Fair enough. Secondly, unification should occur in the context of Germany's continued commitment to NATO, an increasingly integrated European community, and with due regard for the legal role and responsibilities of the Allied powers. Third, in the interest of general European stability, moves toward unification must be peaceful, gradual, and part of a step-by-step process. And lastly, on the question of borders, we should reiterate our support for the principles of the Helsinki Final Act. Well, that last provision is, I hate to say this, is laughable, because the Helsinki Final Act has no status, no standing in international law. It's a purely declaratory instrument. It's played an enormous role. I don't want in any way to be thought to be denigrating the Helsinki Final Act. It played an enormous role in encouraging dissidents in Eastern Europe and helping to produce the result we now see before our eyes. And for that, the Western governments, unfortunately not including the United States government, which were primarily responsible for insisting that there be a final act drawn as this one is, deserve a great deal of credit. But what it says in the Helsinki Final Act about boundaries has no standing in international law. There must be some document which sets these boundaries. Otherwise, Poland is going to be constantly living in fear. The Poles will constantly be living in fear of the development of a renewed German nationalism at some point, it seems incomprehensible or impossible now, which would be demanding the return of those Western territories that Poland was given after the war to compensate for the Eastern territories that the Soviet Union had. But the boundaries ought to be set now. But, you know, I don't think there's anything to stop the Germans from doing that. And I think that is the process that will begin, and that's why I hope that Havel, with the stature that he's got, will be able to push the Western governments to a point where they'll say, well, we have to talk about this. I hope he'll be able to engender enough popular support one place and the other so that the Western governments will have to talk about it. I've got my fingers crossed.
Victor, you?
Mr. Ambassador, if we recognize the sovereignty of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, what about the territory Russia took from Finland in 1940?
The whole Finno-Soviet problem, I've excluded from this. There is a peace treaty with Finland, treaty which we may not like, which some Finns don't like. But the Finns themselves have never, at any point, so far as I'm aware, raised the question in a substantial form of the return of Karelia. That is a bilateral matter between Finland and the Soviet Union now. The Finns have behaved with great courage and wisdom throughout the post-war period. And I don't believe that question really arises. I'm talking here about the territories that are covered by the secret protocol to the Ribbentrop-Molotov Pact of 1939 and the subsequent international instruments that implemented it. And I think we have to be concerned because we are on record. Sumner Wells called in the Soviet ambassador when the three Baltic countries were incorporated in the Soviet Union, said we do not recognize this act, and we've maintained that position ever since. Now we see some people who were saying, well, after all, you know, if this is going to endanger Gorbachev, we may have to think again. I don't think we can have two positions on this. We have one position. Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, if they wish to leave the Soviet Union, are entitled to do so according to provisions of the Soviet Constitution and should be permitted to. Let's leave it to the Lithuanians, Latvians, and Estonians to manage this matter for themselves. And they will manage it, as they have up to now, I think, very wisely. But I think we could accelerate the process if we decided to have a peace treaty with Germany and say to Mr. Gorbachev, we are now giving you, and this is what it would amount to in the eyes of many people in the Soviet Union, they'd be great, we're now giving you a reliable buffer in Europe. We're giving you a situation in which you could not be attacked because there won't be any German army capable of attacking you. You are now going to have this buffer instead of the cordon stalinaire, which has been swept away, as we see, in a matter of 6 months. Instead of that that buffer, which rested on Soviet tanks and Soviet bayonets, we're giving you a reliable buffer in Europe. In exchange for that, you should be willing to tolerate. Actually, I think he is willing anyway, but you should be willing and you should be convincing your colleagues that you should tolerate the exit of Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia from the Soviet Union. There's another problem with Moldavia, which was also covered by that secret protocol. But perhaps we haven't got time to go into the intricacies of Romanian Soviet problems here.
Mr. Ambassador, I had the pleasure of being in Warsaw late October and met Helen and John Davis, who were your followed you.
Yes, indeed.
And I admired her tremendously because she conquered that Polish language, and I study languages and I would never touch it.
Yeah, right.
At any rate, I also, since my husband was taking me along on a business trip, decided rather than be ballast, I would take my camera and my... So I had an hour and a half at the Marriott Hotel with Lech Walesa before he came to America.
Terrific.
With 11 of us, in which he expressed very much what you have been saying. We saw him twice. His friend is Mr. Push. I always love the name. The man who accompanies him is Mr. Push.
Push, yeah.
And we met later with Mr. Push and his family and all that. But he did express his hapless state in where they want to go and why they can't do much at the moment. This particular one being with the oil and gas people, a company that wants to bring gas to Poland. They won't go into that.
Mm-hmm.
But it was very interesting, and we saw him twice after that, and it is a hapless situation momentarily, of course. And I also wish to say just one thing. I had along with me my little, I was so proud to find that I'm doing my mother's memoir. Austrians were that willing to be a part of the Nazi world. I was there in 35. I know none of my friends wanted to. I know that Papa told Wells, who lived across the street, and other people, which is why we were allowed, Roosevelt permitted us to stay in this country when the Finns and the Hungarians and the Poles and everybody else had to go home. Because Papa warned them about Hitler. And there are lots of Austrians who knew this was not a good man. Mm-hmm. End of story. I hate to hear poor Austria being slaughtered all the time.
Yeah.
It's not really so.
Yeah.
Next question. Wilford,
can I get your reaction to two small incidents? I have a German friend who I want to not expose here, and I asked him, I said, suppose we allowed you to unite, what would be the first thing you would do?
Right.
He said, I would demand the return of East Prussia. Three days later, I was reading the New York Times as sort of one of these snippets in the back, and it was talking about some German village, East German village, on the Oder.
Mm-hmm.
On the other side of the Oder, it was a Polish village, which was once part of German Silesia.
Right.
It said that the relations between these two villages just across the river were just sulfurous with hatred. How general is that?
Well, the feelings run very deep, needless to say. However, I think there's another side to this story, too. And that is this, that Silesia and Pomerania, Pomorze, Poznania, the Posen area, these are border areas. The populations are very mixed. Of course, the same is true on the other side of the Oder, in what is now East Germany. You have many families with Polish or Slavic names. The original population of that area was Slavic. And you still have the Sords and the Wends living around Lausitz, Łużyce, as we would say in Polish. So, you know, these populations are very mixed, and there is an interrelationship among them. So I don't think it's all hatred. There is a great deal of it, of course. The memory of what the Nazis did, of what the German armies did in 1939 and subsequently is very vivid. All over Poland you have shrines to the people who were arbitrarily slaughtered as a result of the struggle that went on. These hatreds are very deep. That is why, of course, there must be a solid recognition by any German state to which we give the go-ahead for unification of those boundaries. And the only way I can see it is by means of such an instrument as I had suggested here. Now, with regard to your German friend who said I would demand the return of East Prussia, how old...
He was 15 in Berlin at the time of the war ended.
The time the war ended.
Italy.
So they came from East Prussia. Yeah, there would be some people who would demand this. Of course, there are no Germans left in East Prussia. There are what are called Volkswagen Deutsche left in Silesia. That is, people who, although they don't speak any German at all, claim they are German, and they have ethnic grounds for that, a grandmother or a grandfather. But who would like to go on and buy themselves a Volkswagen in West Germany after they've lived there for a while. So these Volkswagen Deutsche continue to come to Germany from Poland. They've been coming out in great numbers. But I think your example shows how absolutely necessary something more than the Helsinki Final Act is as a guarantee for the boundaries that now exist.
I'd like to follow up on that because I don't quite understand under what organization or what institution such a treaty or agreements would be made.
Well, there would be a conference. It'd have to be a peace conference. Wonderful thought for, you know, all the bureaucrats. This could go on for quite a while. And it would be in some very comfortable place, I would assume. Maybe they'd go to Geneva. If they're unlucky, it would be in Stockholm. Or they would have subcommittees, you know, scattered out. Vienna, Stockholm, Geneva, Zurich, one place and the other. So this would be a long, drawn-out, relatively speaking, conference. I don't see any reason why it should be, but bureaucrats, when they get to pleasant places like that, usually find they can't complete the work in more than less than a couple of months, at any rate. There would have to be a peace conference, which would include all the people I've named in here, representatives of all those states. Now, Mr. Gorbachev has been proposing, and he proposed at Malta, at the Malta summit, a meeting of the 35 signatories to the Helsinki Final Act as the forum in which there should be further discussion or discussion of the future of Europe. Initially, President Mitterrand was against that. Mitterrand initially was saying, well, we can stand, he wasn't very happy about it, but we can stand the reunification of Germany. Right? I mean, Germany's our good friend. But then President Mitterrand went to Kiev and met with Gorbachev, and when he came back, he was all in favor of the 35-nation CSCE conference. Now, the 35-nation CSCE conference obviously was designed by the Soviets as a way of postponing, if not drowning, pushing off to the Greek Kalends, the idea of reunification of Germany, because the Soviets would hope to find in such a conference enough support, and they would, I think, against the reunification of Germany. That is why it seems to me that crucial to the realization of any plan such as I've sketched would be the American attitude, and why it is so disappointing to find people like George Kennan saying now is not the time for the reunification of Germany. Of course, Henry Kissinger has said, NATO. A reunified Germany must be part of NATO. But why? For defense against whom? I don't know. But there would be a peace conference.
It's interesting to note that Havel's first trip abroad was to East Germany and West Germany. Despite the fact I've said from my personal observations that the Czechs are Slavic-speaking Germans, the affinity is so close there, the influence, German influence, even now, after World War II, they changed, a lot of them changed their names. Fingerhofer became Naperstek, and so on and so on. Pol became Dobersky, and so on. So there's this very close cultural, intellectual cross-fertilization, so that I can perfectly well understand where Czechoslovakia stands on the German.
Well, and Havel got into a little bit of trouble, I don't think a lot, but a little bit of trouble in Czechoslovakia by saying, well, when he was in Munich, by saying, well, maybe we Czechoslovaks have to recognize that we did some fairly unjust things when we pushed the Sudetendeutsche out of the Sudetenland. And that created a bit of a storm. There were people in Czechoslovakia said, no, we didn't do anything bad. But of course, bad things were done then. At the end of the war, on both sides. I think what the Czechs did was infinitely less reprehensible than what the Germans did during the 7 years they were in Czechoslovakia, not to mention Poland and all the other places they wreaked havoc. But Havel is determined, as this, what Bill mentioned, shows, to go forward with this, and I just am going to feel very badly if this, I would say, gallant man who has sat in prison for his beliefs and who has led this revolution so adroitly doesn't get fairly strong support from some quarters here in this country when he makes the proposal, because it does seem to me that through this kind of proposal we have an opportunity to make a peace which might have a chance of lasting in Europe.
Mr. Ambassador, we have a missing chair here. General Galvin was at the Charlottesville Council on Foreign Relations, I gather, and I didn't hear him, but I've heard lots of reports of mm-hmm. it last week.
Mm-hmm.
And if he were filling the missing chair, I think the argument he would make would be the argument you've heard many times, but that that the Pentagon and the military are likely to, perhaps, to advance. It runs somewhat as follows. Gorbachev has devalued the military within the Soviet Union and for economic and other reasons. But now he's confronted with Azerbaijan, tomorrow with Georgia, whatever else is going to happen, we don't know. He's given warning to Iran that if Iran muddies the water and intervenes, that there will be an irrevocable major response by the Soviet Union. Isn't it possible that you could get, therefore, a resurgent emphasis on military strength and the existing strength that is still present in the Soviet Union, 30 days ammunition and so on, in Eastern Europe? And so the argument is that rather than being less important, NATO for the future as a safeguard against that is more important, as Galvin and others make the argument. How would you react to that kind of an argument?
Well, I would start by quoting George Kennan, Adam, again, of course, to him, George Kennan would not carry very much weight, I think. But it really is unimaginable to me. Hey, you know, the Polish army, look, the Polish army, the Czechoslovak army, the Hungarian army, all these armies have been vastly neglected for the better part of 15 years. For 15 years, the Soviet Union has been trying in the Warsaw Treaty Organization to get these countries to spend more to modernize their forces without success. They don't have the means. They don't have the resources to modernize their forces. So all these armies have run down very much. The same, of course, is true in less significant measure of the Soviet Union itself. There are just other things they have to do with their resources now. Now, certainly it is possible that there would be some resurgence of emphasis upon the military if they find it impossible to handle areas like Azerbaijan. But I don't think they're going to find it impossible to handle areas like Azerbaijan. They've got enough soldiers to take care of that. Gorbachev, and I don't want to put this policy on Gorbachev. I don't know, you know, Gorbachev is in a minority in the Politburo. He and one or two other so-called liberals are confronted with a so-called moderate majority and some conservatives at the other end of the spectrum, and they're no longer running things. So you can't say that Gorbachev made the mistake, but they've made gross errors in handling this business in Armenia and Azerbaijan, precisely in order to avoid offending the Azerbaijanis, who are the more numerous as between the two. And they've ended up by offending both of them equally. And of course, to the point now that the Azerbaijanis are talking about leaving Soviet Union. The Armenians have nowhere to go. That was the reason that they favored the Azerbaijanis. The Armenians have nowhere to go. They're dependent, lost in a sea of Turks to the west, to the east, and Muslims to the south, all around them. The Armenians have nowhere to go, and they look traditionally to Russia as their protector. But the Azerbaijanis, of course, have got some place to go. However, I don't believe that Iran, weak as it is, can mount any kind of threat after the Iran-Iraq war. I don't see any reason why they can't handle the situation. It's involved already some quite considerable bloodshed, and may involve some quite considerable additional bloodshed. They will be able to handle the matter. They'll be able to get Azerbaijan under control. They should reinstitute president's rule, as Sakharov recommended, over Nagorno-Karabakh. That was a mistake they made, turning it back from being run by Moscow to being run by Baku. So I think they can handle this situation. Now, how things are going to go from there on, I don't know. There are many problems. Mr. Gorbachev and his colleagues are in one terrible mess. Regrettably, there is nothing we can do, nothing essential we can do, it seems to me indispensable we can do, to help him out of this mess, except what I have outlined. And I think that would help him a great deal. He would be able to say, well, look, we have got a buffer. We don't have to worry about the West at all anymore. But as for mounting any kind of military attack in Europe, there was an admiral referred to in that special issue of The Atlantic last summer, which was an excellent issue on defense. And I think it's Colonel Harry Summers referred to this admiral who just given a briefing on the Soviet threat. And he had a whole set of slides, and one of these great Pentagon briefings, a slide comes up and he points here, and then the next slide comes up and points there, and this, that, we need more forces, and so forth. So after the briefing was over, somebody said to the admiral, Admiral, what would happen if the Soviet threat suddenly disappeared? The admiral laughed and said, I'd get me another set of slides.
Any other questions?
Yes. Ambassador Davies, you supplement the exciting prospect and the very timely one that you have given us for a basic settlement in Europe with suggestions of what our government should do to help the Polish government, the Hungarian government, to stabilize in this period of tremendous economic and political ferment and danger.
Well, I'm glad to see that President Bush's initial rather, grudging response to the challenge has been enlarged or increased by the Congress. But I don't really think it's a problem primarily for the United States. It's primarily a problem, here again, we come back to Europe and primarily to Germany. And the Germans are doing a splendid job. They have provided, they are providing funds, they are providing the financial backing, they're taking an interest in the development of these economies. Now we're doing a few things. General Motors is going to go into Hungary and apparently, judging by what one reads, and help manufacture automobiles. Rupert Murdoch, the English tabloid king, has made an investment in a Hungarian weekly, reform-minded Hungarian weekly, something a little different for him. But there are many things that will be done and can be done short of the investment of massive funds in that area. The World Bank is doing what it should do. The Japanese are helping. So I think there are other sources apart from the United States. You have the, so far as the polls are concerned, a vast diaspora here in the West, which is also helping on a family-to-family basis. So I think Poland is going to, I'm knocking on wood, is going to weather this winter of trial. I think they will make it. They have a very able expert leadership now in Leszek Balcerowicz, the new Minister of Finance, outstanding American friend, of course, but outstanding. And the Hungarians have the best bankers in Europe. The Czech economy is not badly off. Not badly off. I think East Germany is the one that is worst off at the moment, because you've got this continuing outflow. 1,000 East Germans are leaving for the Federal Republic every day, and will continue to leave for the Federal Republic every day until the prospect of unification. There's an argument about whether you should say unification or reunification. Until the prospect of unification becomes sure, until they know that there will be one Germany, then they can stop leaving. Meanwhile, the East German economy is going down every day. All the young doctors, all the young professional people, many engineers, people who have any choice of any chance of finding a job in West Germany are leaving. And as you know, the Schengen countries, that is the Benelux countries, Luxembourg, Belgium, the Netherlands, and West Germany, canceled the agreement they had made to sign on December the 15th a document abolishing their borders among themselves, among the five there. They canceled it because they were worried that as soon as they canceled the borders, all the East Germans would start flowing into those countries. And Kohl was worried that this would complicate his relationships with those other countries and worsen his chances for reunification. So how many more distortions are we going to want to see in the developing European federalism, which already has enough problems to deal with, through our refusal to countenance or our reluctance? Because nobody says they refuse. No, there's no one saying they refuse to countenance German reunification. They just say, well, it'll take a little time, you know. Nobody gives any timetables. Take a little time, and of course they've got to be members of NATO and all these conditions. I think the East European countries can make it. I think the real problem right now is East Germany. I exclude that. The others can make it.
Could the United States do more in helping the adjustment of the debt problem?
Oh, absolutely, and we are. The Paris Club, as it's called, has granted a certain number of deferrals to the Poles, who have this fantastic, you know, foreign debt, which now is above $40 billion with the interest that has accrued. And the Paris Club has been doing the right thing. As I say, the West, I think, is doing the right thing, taken as a whole. And I think it is a problem for the West more as a whole than it is for the United States alone. Where I wish we would show leadership is on the political side now, as you gather.
I'm sure most of you have other questions you'd like to ask. Perhaps you could ask them privately of Ambassador Davies. We're terribly grateful to him for spending these hours with us, and we want him to know that we hope very much he'll come back and report on a successful peace conference sometime in the future.